Well, good morning once again. And Father's Day, you know, I had trouble all week just figuring out what I wanted to say. And Marion was helping me last night kind of fine-tune, you know, what to talk about today. And obviously it's Father's Day, and I wanted to do something that connected with that. And Marion reinforced that. So here we are, but how to approach it? What is it that we want to say about fathers? And what is it that we want to say about our Father in heaven? Because there's a definite one-to-one correspondence there. And even though there's not the same emotional content to Father's Day that I think there is with Mother's Day, and there's a reason for that, too, that I think we can probably discuss a little bit this morning. But it was funny because I stayed up, you know, as I do, late last night, working on the message. And this morning, I actually got up 15 minutes early. Can you believe it? So I had an extra 15 minutes to sit. And I usually go over the notes again and just kind of go over it in my head. And whatever compelled me to look at the news, just some news articles, I ran across an article this morning that turns out I want to share with you. And it was one of those spur-of-the-moment things, but it is about Father's Day, and it comes from John Cass, who writes for the Chicago Tribune. And just take a listen to what he has to say, and I think you'll understand why it hit me. What are we going to do on Father's Day? Burn some meat? Put on the new polo shirt? Say thank you for the cologne you'll never wear? Yeah, somebody picked the day. It really doesn't matter who picked it. But if you're a dad, you know the exact date. It's the day your kids were born, the day your flesh came into the world to confront you. If you're not a dad, you can't understand it. Not really. Before becoming a father, I thought it was possible to understand, but reason alone just doesn't work. Perhaps it happened in a room of balloons and flowers with grandparents and siblings all around, your wife smiling, tired, and video cameras working. Or perhaps you were in the hospital chapel at night, bargaining against bad news. However it turned out for you, it was the day God bended and formed you like a link in a chain, connecting you to the generations behind you and the generations hopefully to come. It's the day men stop floating and become rooted in the earth, joined to it, knowing their place in it waits for them, because something of them will continue on. A baby's eyes are so big a few minutes after he arrives, so wide. And I was terribly frightened of the stare. I knew the twins couldn't really see me just then, that all they were processing was light and shadow and wonder, but it was frightening all the same. Their eyes demanded accountability. Wow. After their birth, the big Italian doctor with the hands of a bricklayer had hustled me and the boys outside while he set about saving their mom's life. He put the three of us in a little room, almost a closet. When you go through the pregnancy bit with the book and about what to expect and the relatives and friends offering advice and jokes and the group dynamics of that breathing class where the women raise their hands insisting that they'll do it naturally, drug-free, perhaps at home like their great-grandmothers, maybe in water or whatever the style is at the time, there's one thing you don't expect, that your wife could die. But there we were. The boys had been what the doctor called distressed, although it was worse than that. The bricklayer had to work quickly. He reached in with his big hands and saved their lives and their brains and kept them whole. But there was a trade-off, and her flesh paid for it. The term is hemorrhage, and I just couldn't get my mind around it as they rushed me out of the delivery room and he went about saving her life too. It took hours and hours, all night, and I just sat there on a metal folding chair in a little room. The boys in trays were so tiny, their big eyes staring at me as I prayed. One had a shock of black Sicilian hair like Dondi in the old comic strip, and his brother was little and wouldn't eat. I wasn't strong. I told them I couldn't do it without their mother. I couldn't raise them alone, and I didn't want to. We'd waited 10 years to have them, 10 long years of hoping and wondering, and I knew I just couldn't fly solo. But they just stared at me. Now they're 6-footers with chin beards, using that body wash that advertisers promise will attract all those gorgeous supermodels. And their mother is fine, and we love to sit together and watch the boys run on soccer fields. They're good kids. But when they were little, I'd write about them, and readers would tell me they'd become teenagers someday. And it actually happened. Sometimes they tell their mother and me that we just don't understand things. We don't understand what life is like. And we agree, and we tell them to take the garbage out anyway, and wonder what they'll look like when they're fathers and wearing their polo shirts and don't understand what life is like either. I just love that. So fathers, that's for you. The day that we remembered, where we realized that we had someone we were going to be accountable to in a way that we just can't get in life otherwise. And then I was thinking that yesterday presented a whole different side of fatherhood. Yesterday we had the memorial for a young boy who died of a drug overdose. And this room was filled, you know, to the max, probably 150 plus people here. And I'd say at least half to two-thirds of them were friends of the young man, all 20-something, you know, 20, 21, 19, in that range. And when someone dies that young, you can imagine the emotional content of the room. It was just wrenching, you know, so many tears, but then a lot of laughter too. It always amazes me at these memorial gatherings that we have that the complete range of human emotion is on display. Everything, you know, hysterical laughter as we remember some of the moments that they've had with their loved one, and then just abject grief, just puddles on the floor and everything in between. And the thing that I always want to remind everybody when we're having such a gathering is that there are no words that we can use to take away the pain or the grief of someone who's going through that kind of tragedy. And if you try, you just make it worse. You just trivialize the pain that they're going through. You know, the best we can do is keep our mouths shut and just sit there and be with them. Because the greatest gift that we have, the greatest gift that we can ever give anybody, is just our presence. All we are is our time here. And the way that we use our time is by giving our presence to people and places and things. And at the end of our life, I suppose, you know, our life is going to be measured by the choices we made of where to put our presence. And just like this morning, since you can only be in one place at one time, you say with your presence, this is the most important place you can be. You say with your presence, these are the most important faces that you can be with right now. That's your choice, and it's a beautiful thing. And we're all here together because we chose this place, of all the other places, to be right here and right now. And that's the gift that we give to someone in grief. That's how we begin this journey that is grief. And there's no way to do it. There's no way to shortcut it. It has to just be lived through. And we're saying we're going to take the journey with you, and that's a beautiful thing. And you can literally watch the healing begin, even in the midst of the tears. Tammy, Shane's mother, kneeling over here with her head on the shoulder of a 20-year-old girl, just wailing uncontrollably, comforting her, the mother of a dead son. Wow. And for those of you who don't know, this was a stepson of our drummer, Dave. And so it really hit our community hard. You know, I've been playing with Dave in bands for 9 years now, Lisa and I and Joe. It's an indescribable thing to try to share that kind of family tragedy. And so in Dave, in his fatherhood with Shane, I saw this other side. And there are some things that you just can't manufacture, especially in a setting like that. And the last three speakers who spoke, you know, it wasn't planned. It just worked out that way. After all of this, you know, people sharing and music and everything, Dave finally stood up to speak. And if you don't know Dave, Dave can't do anything that's not funny. And he stood up just at the right moment and gave us the comic relief that we so desperately needed, just by regaling us with stories about him and Shane and the way they used to butt heads all the time, you know. And everybody laughed. And then right after he spoke, a young girl, 20, 21, got up and just gave the most clarion call to recovery that you could ever possibly imagine. And since it was coming from one of their peers, it had weight. It had teeth and traction, you know, because she was saying, don't go this way. If you need help, ask for it. And she was just calling out to her friends, I don't want to go to another one of these. And so many of them talked about having 5 friends die in the last year and a half. You know, it's just crazy what's going on. And then right after that, Jody Barber came up, who lost her son and has produced a movie called Overtaken, and it just led perfectly into that. And so here was this beautiful segue. But before all that happened, Uncle Mike stood up, Shane's uncle, and he talked. And he said something that really hit me. He said that Shane had always considered Dave his dad, always considered Dave his father. And that really hit me too. Dave is not his biological father. Dave is someone who came into Tammy's life and then therefore into Shane's life. And for all that headbutting that he talked about, and for all the grousing that he might have done about Shane's decisions and choices and the way that he was going, Shane confided to his uncle that he always considered Dave his father. So what makes a father? What did Dave do that was so right with Shane? Well, he had the role. Shane's biological dad was not in the picture. But this is what Dave gave him. He gave him his presence. He was there for years as Shane grew up. He was there with him in the good times and the bad, in the confrontations and the good moments. He was present. He was there. He was father. That's what it is. It all keeps coming back to presence. It all keeps coming back to simply showing up and being there for other people. That's what we're really talking about here. And I was thinking about our gathering. I was thinking about how, you know, here we are in this little funky room and our little kind of ragtag way that we go about doing things. I have to laugh. Some people say that, you know, they really distrust organized religion. I say, well, come here. We're really disorganized. It works. And so we're informal, you know. We're non-liturgical. The gathering yesterday literally was put together upstairs between me and Tammy scratching it out because the week just got away from her. She couldn't think straight, you know, and it just worked. You know, the Spirit was guiding it. And we see that as the way of intimacy with our community. But I remember 4 years ago going to a funeral of a friend, the receptionist at an office in which I had worked 4 years before that. And she was a Catholic among Catholics. She was a former nun, and she was the sweetest, sweetest lady. And when she died, of course, she had a full Catholic funeral and mass, the whole nine yards. And I grew up Catholic, and I went to Catholic school for 12 years, joined a monastery after that. But when I left the monastery, I pretty much left the Catholic faith, and by this time had found myself planted in an evangelical setting. But as soon as I sat down with that mass, it all just came back. You know, it just doesn't go away. It's worse than riding a bicycle. It's just, it's in there. It's planted. It's part of my DNA now. And as they were going through the liturgy and all the responses, I knew them all, and I found myself saying them, and I was just getting lost in that liturgy. And yet here I am in this completely different setting. Here's the big vaulted ceilings and the nailed down pews and the vestments and the incense. You know, they actually asked me to be a pallbearer, so I'm carrying in the casket. And here's this formality and all of this pomp and circumstance. And yet I'm getting lost in it just the same. And one of my ex-coworkers, his name is Chris, he was sitting right next to me on my left, and he's an Anglican. So if you know anything about the Anglican Church, they're as Catholic as you can be without being Catholic. About the only difference is they don't recognize Rome, but they have the same liturgy, and he's going through the liturgy as well. And at one point he leaned over and whispered in my ear and asked, do you miss the liturgy? And it was exactly what I was thinking. I miss this. I miss this reverence. I miss this increased register. I miss that the churches are made big so that we can feel small in God's presence. There's something about the awe and the, was it numinous awe is the word for it, that occurs at times like this. And then there was a funny moment because Maura's brother was sitting on the other side, and of course he's a Catholic, and so he leans over to me because it was communion time, and in Catholic Church you're only supposed to take communion if you're a Catholic in good standing and don't have any venial sins on your soul and that sort. So anyways, he leans over and says, are you Catholic? And just to keep things simple, I said yes, because I didn't feel like going through all this stuff. Yeah, I'm a Catholic. Okay, then he turns to Chris. Are you Catholic? Well, he was Anglican. He said no. So then he starts to explain it to Chris. Well, you know what? We're going to go up to take communion now, but you know, you can just sit there and it's no problem. And Chris turns to him and he says, well, I'm Anglican. Can I take half? I was just one of those moments. I was doing everything I could to keep from bursting out laughing. And, you know, you got to know Chris's sense of humor. He meant it that way. But, you know, the other guy was just like, oh, you know, I'm trying to backtrack and apologize and everything. We all ended up going up and taking communion. My point in saying all this is that I was just as connected, just as lost, just as present in that kind of setting, in the formality of the liturgy, as I was yesterday, in the disorganized way that we go about our relationship with God here. You know, everything is beautiful as long as we bring our presence to it. We need to bring our presence to it, and then it makes it sacred. It's not the style, it's not the culture. Anything can work if we bring our presence to the moment. And so presence keeps becoming the main thing that we're talking about here. And we need a balance, don't we? Because we become so familiar with our God, does that mean He's still not the creator of the heavens and the earth? Does that mean that He still can't span all of the cosmos with His hand's breadth? He still is that God. And we kind of move between the two. We should be oscillating between the two. There should be balance. And we've lost that. But the presence is the key. The presence is what keeps bringing us back. God is always present to us. But are we? And if we are more comfortable in an informal setting, then that's where we need to be in order for us to be able to let go and be present to God. And if we need a more formal setting, we do that too. But on Father's Day, today, what I want to do is to consider this all-important relationship with our Father in heaven that is also connected to our relationship with our Father here on earth. When we had Mother's Day last month, I talked about the Hebrew names of Father and Mother, and I don't want to do the long version of that, but just the short version is that Father in Hebrew is Ab. You know, two letters, R, A, and B, they're Aleph and Beit, and it literally means a strong house. The Father as seen like the pole that keeps the tent up and gives structure to the tent. That's literally the Father's role. He's the one who gives structure. He is the administrator. He is the king, if you will, of that particular clan. He's the judge and the executioner and the warrior and the administrator of that particular family. He gives the family not only strength, but sustenance. He gives them continuity. Mother, M, E-M, Aleph again, which can be either A or E in our language, and Mem means literally strong water, and that needs a little explanation, because when the Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews, would tan their hides and boil them, a thick, sticky white substance would come to the top that they used as an adhesive. And so strong water was literally glue, and the mother was seen as the glue that held the family together. The emotionally connected one. So the father gave the strength and the umbrella under which the woman, the mother, could knit the family together emotionally. And so here we start to see the roles that father and mother play. You know, and the father is kind of representing the macro. It's the family's link and connection with the larger world and working with the group of the family itself, which could literally be dozens or even hundreds of people because their family was extended. And the mother always working in the macro, connecting heart to heart and person to person within that group. Two very needed and related aspects. And so the Hebrews looked at God as their father in that sense. From their nation's point of view, Father God was their king. And he felt and filled all those roles. He was the king. He was the commander-in-chief, the warrior, the executioner, the judge, the administrator. He filled all that. And that's how they saw him in that role. And they called him Ab. They called him Father. He was also Avun. Avun with that extra added syllable there. Means the creator of all, the builder of all. the cosmic parent, if you will, the father of everyone and everything that crawls or creeps. But they saw him in that large macro sense. And as you read the Old Testament, that's the sense that you get a father, isn't it? He looks a little distant. He looks a little bit foreboding and scary. You know, he's alternately angry and yet described as compassionate. But what really comes through is the warrior and the judge and the executioner, because they are looking at him through that macro lens. Now, Jesus is sometimes described as a revolutionary. Now, in the way that we normally use that word, I absolutely disagree. Jesus was not a revolutionary in a political sense. Jesus was not trying to achieve social justice for the macro. Every time that mantle was thrown on him, he cast it off. That wasn't what he was about. But Jesus was absolutely revolutionary in that he called his father by another name. He called his father Abba, which in Aramaic means papa. It means daddy. It's the intimate form of the word that children use. Just like Emma is mommy, Abba, daddy. In that one fell swoop, you have to understand, what would that have come across like to his first hearers? They're used to Ab. They're used to Avun. They're used to this creator God. Somewhere in Shemaiah, somewhere up in the heavens. And now here's Jesus talking about him as Abba. Abba, into whose lap we crawl. Abba, whose shoulder we can bury our face in. Abba, who shelters us as we remember our own fathers. Absolutely mind-blowing that Jesus would talk this way. Mind-blowing that he would bring this in. You know? So, as soon as Jesus does that, he's not abolishing the old, he's bringing balance. He's bringing balance as the king is balanced by the servant. The father is balanced by the mother. The formal is balanced by the informal and the familiar. The awe, that numinous awe, is balanced with intimacy. Jesus is telling us it's not either or, it's both and. We can bring these things together. This God that we sometimes see as so distant, this God that we sometimes relate to the relationship we had with our earthly father, has another side to him that we have not experienced, possibly. And until we do, we cannot know who he is. Not really. We can't know the love that he has for us or the way that he sees us as his children. I've known three men who were raised by fighter pilots, and I'm telling you, they had a hard time looking at God as anything other but that exacting, demanding father that was living in their memory. And because father is dealing with the macro, right, there is something that is expected of us in his eyes. With our fathers, we have to earn that respect a lot more than we do with mothers. Mothers, you know, they'll love any face, right? If it's theirs. Only a face a mother could love. And so we attach that on to our father, and it's very difficult for us to see him, both as expansive and awe-inspiring, but also immediately present, that we can literally crawl in his lap. Now, how do we know this? How can we find this father that Jesus is talking about? Jesus puts it very simply. He says, seek first the kingdom and God's righteousness, and all else will be added. This presence that we're talking about, this engagement in the moment that we're talking about, is kingdom. That is a perfect definition of kingdom, the way Jesus is using it. Not about heaven, not about anything, any earthly territory. It's about this quality of life that occurs when we engage the moment, when we really bring our presence to what is happening right in front of us. Everything else is added. And he says, if you will do this, you will know a truth, and the truth will set you free. For Jesus, kingdom living creates the awareness of Abba. How can we know Abba unless we've actually sat in his lap? See, we can do Ab, we can do Avun all by ourselves. Because that's the way the world works, isn't it? You don't get something for nothing. You know, you get to keep what you kill. What's the other way we can look at this? You know, there's no free lunch. We have to earn things. We know about Ab. We know about that side of things. What we don't know is the good news that Jesus was trying to bring about Abba. And the only way we can do that is through this way of Jesus. Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through me. What he's saying is this way of kingdom living, this way that I am showing you to love one another as I have loved you, is the way to sit in your Father's lap, the way that you can understand your Abba. The formula for it is right in the Lord's Prayer, and I wanted to take a look at that. It's in your handouts there at Matthew 6, 8. And we all know this. You know? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. But what we need to do is to understand it from an Aramaic point of view. And something else jumps out at us. In Aramaic, avun davashmaya, netkarash shamak, te malkuta, neve sebyanak, aichana davashmaya afvara. The Aramaic rendering gives us a completely different understanding. In English, that first line, our Father in heaven, sets us up for something right away. Our Father in heaven, our Father, Avun, which gives us a sense of the Creator of all, the name of God, the Shem of God, in Hebrew is the outer surface of something that reveals the inner essence or character. It is the inner essence, the character, the reputation. God's inner essence is revealed by the creation that he has created. Our Father in heaven is telling us that we can know something about our Father, that he loves order and harmony and beauty and life because we see it all around us in the cosmos. We see it around us in our lives. But we can't know much more than that until we get to the next line, Nitkarash Shemak, which literally means holy is your name. But that kadash there, which means holy, means to set something aside. It means to clear a space for it. You know, the way we clear a space in order to build a house or clear a space in order to have a gathering. The Hebrew idea of prayer, selah, means literally, it's a hunting term where the hunter lays a snare for the prey. You know, clears the space, lays the snare carefully, covers it all up, and then retreats into the blinds to expectantly wait, silently, breathlessly, for something to happen. That's selah, to lean into, to be attentive, to bring your presence to. That is the idea of prayer to the Hebrew. And so these two things are related. The kadash, to hallowed be your name, to make holy your name, is to clear a space in our lives for something to happen. To clear the space and to wait intently, leaning into, expectantly, for something to change in our lives. So if our Father in heaven is the awareness of our Father and the first traits that we can know just by living our lives and experiencing things, then the second, this clearing of space, this holy is your name, is the preparation. But preparation for what? Preparation for your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. This is the action. Awareness, preparation, action. Without action, nothing changes in our lives. And this idea is simply that whatever your will is, Lord, and will in Hebrew is desire, deepest purpose, pleasure, delight. Whatever your deepest purpose and desire is, Lord, I want it to be mine as well. Whatever is happening in your unity, in Shemaya, in heaven, let it happen here on earth with me and my life as well. Let our two wills become one. Let my will become your will. The paraphrase directly from the Aramaic, our Father in heaven, holy is your name, our Creator and parent of all. All creation carries the signs of your love, desire, and purpose by which you are known. We clear a special place for you, for your love, desire, and purpose in our hearts and lives. Your kingdom come, your will be done as in heaven, so on earth. May your desire and purpose become as real in our hearts and lives as they are in yours. Jesus is giving us the formula for beginning to know Abba, not just Ab, but Daddy, Papa. Awareness, preparation, action. Really moving into the space that the Father occupies. And when we do that, what kind of Father are we going to meet? What does he look like? What is he like? And I know that we've talked about the prodigal son in here before. Pastor Frank was using the prodigal son just last Tuesday for the kids in our recovery gathering. And I put the whole thing down for you, but I don't think I'm going to read it. Let me just paraphrase it for you, because most of you know the story. A father has two sons, and the younger one, who is always the problem child, of course, right? He asks for his inheritance early. And unbelievably, the father does it, gives him, divides it all up, gives him his portion, whereupon he takes off and runs and spends it all. And if you're ever wondering what prodigal means, we tend to think that it means the one who comes back. But really what it means is lavish spending, reckless spending. That's what prodigal is. And that's what he does. He goes out and he spends all his money, and he ends up in the pigsty, just eating the husks that the pigs eat, because he's abjectly, completely out of luck and homeless. And then he comes to his senses and say, even my father's hired servants do better than this. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to tell him I'm not worthy to be your son, but at least hire me as one of your servants. And he sets off. To get a little context here, in a Hebrew culture where the sons never left the clan, you know, it was the daughters that came and lived with their husbands. And so the clan kept growing and everybody stayed together. And the family wealth was their survival. It was their sustenance. And so to do anything to chip away at the survivability of the family was punishable by death. What this son did was to literally say, I wish you were dead. I don't care if this family survives. Give me what is mine and I'm taking it away and spending it. He could have been killed on the spot. What does the father do? Accedes to his wishes. Lets him go. And then as the story progresses, and he comes back, we learn that the father has been waiting for him all along. There was never a moment that the father wasn't praying for his son to return. And as soon as he catches sight of him way over there, just over that rise, coming over the edge of his property, he doesn't just wait for him to arrive at his doorstep. He bolts out the door and runs to him. And imagine this, an old man, the patriarch, pulling up his robe and sprinting. First of all, Hebrew patriarchs didn't run. It was undignified. Hebrew patriarchs didn't show skin. You know, that was indecent, immodest. And when he gets up to the boy, before he can say anything, he wraps himself around him, practically tackles him. Imagine, this guy just got out of the pigsty, right? So he's not smelling too good. The father, in his patriarchal robes, just hugging this kid. And saying that he kissed him does not do justice to the language. It's really the sense that he couldn't stop kissing him. He smothered him with kisses. And finally, the boy gets a moment to speak and starts into his speech. And before he can even complete it, the father is ordering that the calf be killed and the party to start. He doesn't even wait for the words to come out of his mouth. We don't even know if the boy was sincerely sorry for what he did. You know, it could have been just enlightened self-interest. At least my father's servants do better than I am here. We don't even know what his motives were. And it didn't matter. All he had to do was show up. All he had to do was bring his presence to the presence of the Father, and the connection was made. Can we start to see what Jesus is saying here? As the story progresses, the elder brother is incensed because he was the faithful one. He was the one who stayed all these years. And yet the father never gave him a party for his friends. And you know what? The elder brother is right. The father was being unfair. The father was being unjust. But you got to learn to live with that, because the father's love is perfect. It's not fair and it's not just. It's just perfect. And it's always perfectly unjust and unfair in favor of the beloved. That's who Abba is. That's who Daddy is. He turns to the elder brother and he says, son, everything I have is already yours. You can't get any more than you already have. And to diminish your brother's share is not going to give you any more. We have to celebrate because he was dead and he came back to life. What part of everything don't we understand? He has already given us everything. As you sit there right now, as I sit here right now, we have everything we need to be full sons and daughters of God with all of the rights and privileges thereto. There is nothing that we lack except the understanding that it's already here. We run around out there trying to find something, but it's just right here and it's right now. Jesus is telling us, your Abba is that kind of God. But you will never know that. You will never understand that until you walk this way of awareness and preparation and action that brings you into the presence of a God that is so unfairly loving that you won't even believe it until you experience it. This is our Abba. This is our Daddy. And this Father's Day, I hope that we can start to create a desire in ourselves that is greater than our fear of the risk that we feel when we try to do something different than we've always done. If there is anything in you that keeps you from being completely transparent, if there are secrets that you can't tell, if there are things that keep you from being able to look directly into someone's eyes for as long as the conversation lasts because you're afraid they're going to see something in there, that you're going to be found out. If there's anything like that that keeps you, it's keeping you from the presence, the full presence of the moment. Those are the things that need to be purged. Those are the things that need to be just brought out into the sunlight so that you can be fully present and realize there is nothing to fear. There is nothing that we need to be afraid of when we're sitting in Daddy's lap. But we can't get to Daddy's lap until we bring our full presence to this moment, right here and right now, because this moment is the only place we'll ever find our Abba. Ab can live in our heads, Abba only in the moment, present to the moment, present to our God, and we'll find our Father. Let's pray. Father, thank you for our fathers that you have given us here on this earth. Although the example may not have always been good, we need an earthly grounding to begin to understand the relationship that we have with you. So thank you for our fathers, but thank you for the role models that have come into our lives even when biological fathers were not present. Thank you for teachers, and thank you for friends and brothers and guides and whoever helps us to understand that there is a love that we can't lose. Thank you for being our Father. Thank you for being Abba, our Daddy, and always waiting for us, waiting to run to us and wrap yourself around us, waiting to be undignified and immodest in our favor. Thank you, Lord, for exactly who you are. Help us to find you and find our place at your table. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.